What sort of person are you?
Well, it's hard to say. Just average, I guess.
Are you adventurous? And kind? Are you kind?
I try to be.
And sensitive? Do you sense things?
Welcome to The Drunken Odyssey with John King, a podcast about the writing life.
Tell us, oh muse, about a man whose mind and career has careened far and wide and upside down, whose computers are seared with crimes against grammar, whose typographical aggressions are legion, whose words flow into the very mouth of time, and more than a few bottles. A man who actually owns a typewriter, and perhaps even a soul.
And now, your host, John King.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to episode 5 of The Drunken Odyssey with John King. I am your host, Wayne Newton. On today's Odyssey, I'll be talking to Monica Wendell, the poet, and we will also hear from Olivia Kate Cerrone, who first appeared on episode 1 of The Drunken Odyssey. On today's show, she'll be discussing the film The Watcher in the Woods. You can find us at thedrunkenodyssey.com, and if you want to write in with questions, observations, do so at thedrunkenodyssey@gmail.com. So what's dominating my life right now is that I'm going to be moving, but I haven't moved yet. My life is basically a game of Tetris, except whenever I complete the bottom level, rather than emptying out and creating new room, instead, no room is created and it just keeps going up and up and up, pushing me out of that video game and into a narrative quest game that somehow resembles a mashup of The Grapes of Wrath, King Lear, The Metamorphosis, and Popeye Meets Sinbad the Sailor. Dean Martin, patron saint of drinking oneself through calamity, pray for us. So right now, my writing life seems to be centered around the mental equivalent of a tornado of post-it notes. I'm not sure I'm making much progress on any of these projects, but I can say that at least they are haunting me with thought. So this is one of those great caesuras in my journal in which readers of future times can puzzle over what the hell I may have been doing. Did he go into the Everglades and commune with the alligators? No one can say. Unless they listen to this podcast. So I wonder what you use journals for, if you actually do, in fact, use them. Mostly, I just try to record what I accomplished each day as a form of both back patting and kicking my ass in order to keep myself motivated and working, rather than simply finding a shady cool spot and drinking indefinitely. I also use it as a record of what I've been reading, but I really don't record many thoughts or sustained impressions in this journal. I get the idea that I'm probably doing it wrong, but it's the way that I do it. But I am curious, dear listeners, how you use journals and what value you find in them. So write in if you've got something to say. Or you could just mail me your journal. Okay, so I actually wound up writing in my journal today, and here's what I wrote, which seems to contradict most of what I said earlier. Listening to Bauhaus's Bela Lugosi is Dead from 417 to campus, I felt I was soul traveling, so inhumanly tired as geometric and botanical excrescences glided through me, the chain reaction of snags that brought me here.
And now, the interview of the day.
Monica Wendell is a visiting instructor of English at St. Thomas Aquinas College. Her poetry has appeared in Bellevue Literary Review, Forklift, Ohio, Nimrod, Spoon River Poetry Review, and other journals.
a graduate of NYU's MFA in Creative Writing program. She is the recipient of both Goldwater and Starworks teaching fellowships and has taught creative writing at Goldwater Hospital, NYU, and St. Mary's Healthcare Center for Kids. She is the author of the chapbook Call It a Window, published by the Midwest Writing Center earlier this year. Welcome, Monica.
Hi, I'm glad to be here.
Welcome to the Whisper Room. You're our first phone interview. Congratulations.
So, it's an honor.
At what age did you first become interested in poetry?
I kind of have been writing poetry ever since I knew how to write. I've always written. Recently, my mom discovered a notebook of poems that I had dictated to her even before I was able to write them. So for pretty much my whole life, I wanted to be a writer. I would say, though, that I began thinking about poetry seriously when I was a junior in college. I had sort of a strange undergraduate experience. I started at one school, and then I dropped out, and then I traveled, and then I went to another school. So I really wasn't sure what I wanted to do, and I always figured that I would write until I started getting rejections. And, you know, that kind of just didn't happen. So I would say I seriously started thinking about being a poet and studying poetry, you know, towards the end of my junior year, heading into my senior year of college.
Well, let's talk a little bit about before that, though. You said you were writing, composing poetry before you could even write poetry.
Yeah.
Where did that impulse come from?
I also wanted to be an ice cream man, so, you know, it's not the best predictor.
Well, the jobs are related, arguably. But what was it that made it those early utterances poetry? I mean, were you exposed to poetry that early on?
Yeah, I mean, I was. Well, you know, children's books are pretty close to poems, Dr. Seuss. My parents aren't writers, but they really, really, really valued education. And, you know, I learned to read very early on. When I was little, I also, my little brother is 4 years younger than me, and I taught him how to read. So, you know, I just loved books. And I also was the kind of reader who very eagerly read books that I didn't understand and would be, you know, totally fine with only understanding maybe half of it and then going back and reading and reading and rereading.
And then you said you had an awakening in undergraduate school.
Yeah.
What school were you at for your junior year?
I was at the State University of New York at Geneseo, which is obviously a public school, and it's located in upstate New York, pretty small, only like 5,000 undergrads. And so I was studying philosophy there.
What was it that sparked your renewed interest in poetry?
I had a really good professor, a really good poetry professor there by the name of Dave Kelly. You know, I'm not really sure. I just felt like, I'm not sure how to explain it. Sort of that that my writing was a way that I could actually say something that was important and have people take me seriously.
Well, what was it about that class? Do you remember?
Well, originally I was in a creative writing class that was fiction and poetry, and I wrote mostly fiction in that class. And the professor in that class asked me if I was planning on writing a novel out of one of my short stories, and I said, no, of course not. You know, he wasn't a good teacher by any traditional sense. The classes were really boring. Every once in a while, you know, I didn't religiously attend every class. But he took my writing really seriously, you know, as an equal, I guess. And it was probably the first time in my life that a professor treated me as an equal.
Well, and I
so
find
after that intro to creative writing class, I took two more poetry writing classes with him, a class on 20th century poetry, a directed study on narrative poetry writing, and I was his teaching assistant. All within 2 years, I did, I think, six classes with this one professor.
And who were your favorite poets at the time?
At the time, I was reading, let me think about what I was reading. I don't remember who my favorite poets were at the time. I do remember that I was reading a lot of Don DeLillo, Italo Calvino, oh, and Amos Oz. Amos Oz was probably my favorite poet at the time. He's an Israeli writer. But I was sort of reading a mixture, fiction, poetry, and philosophy.
Amos Oz writes poetry?
Yeah, he has a narrative book of, it's like a novel in verse.
Ah.
It's called The Same Sea.
Hmm. Well, I'm a little bit familiar with him, but apparently not enough.
Yeah, Yeah, it might have actually been the first book that I read by him was The Same Sea. I'm not sure, though. But yeah, The Same Sea is a collection of poems, but it's, you know, it's also a novel it tells. It's about a family and the mother has died.
So it seems like a lot of your inspiration at that time was not traditional poetry or traditional contemporary poetry, despite the oxymoron there.
Yeah, no, it definitely wasn't. You know, even now, I have a lot of difficulty reading poems, and I often, if I'm reading a poet, I often look up their poems on YouTube and watch them read it or listen to them read it. And so I do have difficulty just reading a poem without hearing the poet's voice. So I guess even now I still, you know, I try to be open and inspired by not just poetry.
Let's have you read a poem. So I was wondering if you would be willing to read in supermarkets in Italy.
And this is actually the first poem in my chapbook. In supermarkets in Italy, you have to put on gloves to touch the bananas. I'm not there, though. I'm on the Lower East Side in a bookstore where a little black dog in a skull and bone sweater sleeps on a couch, snoring. A bookstore dog. Whenever I come here, I end up rereading the Redefining Consent anarcho-feminist zine, but never buy. It starts with a female-identified, female-bodied person getting sexually assaulted in college. Generic story, so generic that it lacks verisimilitude, but then moves this weird personal responsibility zone with 83 questions you should ask yourself to find out if you're a rapist. Number one, have you ever proceeded in a sexual situation without prior verbal consent? Number two, if verbal consent was given, did the person's body language or brief moments of hesitation, intake of breath, quickening pulse communicate anything other than consent? Number three, are you aware of your partner's possible abuse history as a survivor of sexual assault or as a frat boy perpetrator pitching past limits up before punch, keys to an ice, and close dancing? Reminding me of the supermarkets in Italy. Reaching for the bananas, my host sister slapped my hand away and pointed to the gloves, miming. In my pidgin Italian, even I understood what she said. How could you have been so stupid?
So I got chills when I read that.
Why? What about it gave you chills?
Well, I think that partly it's the spark of the analogy. It sounds like you're writing a sort of slack-minded hipster poem because the title announces one subject and then you casually say, but we're not talking about that subject.
Yeah.
And then when the subject comes back around, it's helixing around the sort of engagement with politics. And because you end in Italy, it really forces the reader into trying to interpret exactly what you're being stupid about.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that I like about this poem is that I think it captures both my, I don't know, you know, I'm drawn to these things. I'm drawn to these ideas, like that a person should ask themselves questions to find out if they're a rapist. I'm drawn to that, and I'm drawn to these, like, really, you know, I'm drawn into these strong beliefs. But then at the same time, I try to acknowledge, okay, is this getting ridiculous? Like, are these 83 questions ridiculous, or are they real questions that a person should be asking themselves? And, you know, in Italy, it is true. You do have to put on gloves to touch the bananas, and that's what you do to, you know, to keep everyone safe is a way of putting it. So I know I was mentioning that in college I was studying philosophy, and one of the things I struggled with in college was actually whether or not I should go into a medical field. My sister is a doctor and my mom is a nurse. And when I find myself writing about politics, I do often end up talking about politics and the female body and sexuality. But then, you know, I'm also thinking a little bit about, like, bodies, you know, in terms of medicine, in terms of appropriateness. And I like to think that, or even, like, what it means for a person to be safe, I guess, in a physical sense. So, I don't know, I think that, you know, I think of, like, medicine and politics, like, kind of converging when talking about sexuality.
Well, there's definitely a concreteness to your poems, and this one wasn't especially graphic in terms of the sexual politics.
Because people will point out to me, your poems don't have any metaphors in them. And it's not something I try to do, but, like, I do notice that oftentimes I'll write a poem and there will be no metaphor or simile in it, which is part of poetic language often is very full of metaphors and similes. So I think that concreteness, I think that's part of where it comes from, you know?
Well, it's sort of looking at a house and saying, well, I don't think you used a hammer to build that house, rather than simply talking about the house.
Yeah.
Well, the dog is certainly a great objective correlative in the poem, even if it isn't a metaphor or a simile, and sort of does point out rendering the dog cute in a sort of lame punk way sets up the whole sense of skepticism that you sort of bring to this magazine that you're curious about. And the reason why the poem gives me chills is because poetically you've realized this dialectic of sexual politics, because, you know, what we expect when someone says, how could you be so stupid and you're thinking of rape, is that's what the rape victim has been historically inclined to say, you know, self-blame. And that's not what you're saying in the poem, but the echoes of that sort of wash into your own engagement with this magazine that's perhaps taking its own sense of political entitlement to an extravagant degree, even though what it's writing about is very, very important.
Yeah, and part of what drew me to that magazine was the title of the zine, Redefining Consent. like that it's something that can be redefined, that the definition of consent is not something that's written in stone, but can be and maybe should be redefined.
Although as a magazine, does it come out every month?
No, it's like a photocopied zine. You can probably find it a PDF version of it online.
Okay. Is it a one-shot or is it a regular publication, though?
Oh, it's like a one-shot thing.
Okay. Okay. Well, that's a little bit more sensible than what I was imagining. Okay.
Oh, okay. Yeah, they're not redefining consent every single month.
Wow. That would be my ultimate nightmare.
It might be difficult. Well, I mean, I also find myself, like, drawn to, you know, political language on both sides of the spectrum. And I think as a writer, it's important to listen to all these different kinds of language that you hear around you. I recently wrote a poem about Rick Santorum and hearing his voice on the radio. And I think, like, the slogans that you hear at protests, the political things that you hear around you, they're important. And they're a part of our language and a part of our discourse. And I'm drawn to literature that engages with it. And I try to write literature that engage. I don't know. I mean, I know that I really like you. I mean, I had one of my friends one of my coworkers after reading this book texted me and said, what is an anarcho-feminist? and it's funny because for me, that's just a word that I hear a lot and use in the chapbook. But then I found myself unable to define exactly what an anarcho-feminist was. Okay, so an anarcho-feminist is someone who's an anarchist and a feminist. Okay, well, what does that mean?
How does that dictate behavior week in, week out?
Yeah, and you know, if I describe something as being like an anarcho-feminist gene, how is a person supposed to then understand what I mean by that?
Well, do you worry about that some of your references are so specific and that your own engagement with this is so deliberate that you're not necessarily guiding the reader like Ovid through, you know, the Inferno?
Yeah, I do worry about that. And I didn't worry about that until my chapbook, until Call It a Window came out. I never worried about it because most of my audience was, I guess, people who I was familiar with, who knew me. And then after the chapbook came out, I had more than one person ask me, what does this mean? And that's definitely worried me. Or even, you know, I have a poem in here about WikiLeaks. And every once in a while, you know, I'll find someone who's like, well, what is WikiLeaks and why is it important? And yeah, I think now I'm starting to worry about it a little bit more and find it problematic. But then on the other hand, I feel like these are the things I'm concerned with, and these are the words that describe the things I'm concerned with. So what other words can I use?
Well, I'm not sure it's a case of not using the words, but maybe adding to the narrative or adding, I don't know, explanations. And it's something that I'm torn with sometimes because it is like splashing cold water on something that's alive and, you know, for the sake of people who can't recognize what it is. So,
yeah, and you know, it's funny. I was talking with one of my friends about this, and some of my poems are published in print magazines and some are published online. And the poems that are published online, maybe this is asking too much, but I kind of just assume that if somebody doesn't know something, they'll Google it. And, like, I've sort of come to expect, like, okay, if somebody doesn't get it, they'll just type it into Google and see in, like, 2 seconds. But then I don't have that same expectation for print. The WikiLeaks poem is called WikiLeaks Reveals That Military Contractors Have Not Lost Their Case for Child Prostitutes. The headline is from the Huffington Post. And when I wrote it, when I imagined it being published, I imagined the title just linking to the article.
Well, and in that case, I thought the headline was really long as a title, and I felt like that if that didn't do the job, then, yeah, people need to go to Google for that one.
Yeah.
And I didn't feel like I didn't get the references, but then again, I'm probably one of those friends of yours from NYU who...
No, you probably did get the references. I mean, as long as you know what WikiLeaks is, then I think you're all right.
Well, I'm an academic who, yeah, if I'm not politically involved, I'm politically adjacent to those who are.
Yeah.
Well, I also think of, you know, on this issue, and I don't know what you think of it, but no, I'm not going to ask that question.
No, go ahead, ask it. Now I want to know.
Oh, well, I was just, Billy Collins, you know, does a very thorough job of walking his readers through and not leaving his poems too mysterious. The way he puts it is, you know, there are good mysteries and there are bad mysteries, and he just wants the good mysteries for his readers, a little bit for them to chew on without sort of overwhelming them. And I recently taught some of his poems to my students and was shocked to find one student overwhelmed, and he wanted Billy Collins to produce a thesis statement for every poem.
Okay.
And I needed to walk around in the backyard and just think for a while after I read that comment from a student. I didn't know what to do with that.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of graduate school was taking out the things that explained things. That was really what I learned in my 2 years at NYU. In almost every workshop, I had people saying, you're explaining too much, leave some gap. So I'm not sure if I'm successful with it. I know that my poems always make sense to me and never have any mysteries to me, and that's sort of the best I can do. But I also think about what Flannery O'Connor said about a good story, and she said that a good story is one that can be taken on different levels. Okay, or even something like The Simpsons, right? You can watch The Simpsons and just laugh when Homer eats a donut and falls down, but you can also watch The Simpsons and see deeper themes or political issues. And that's what I aim for with my poems. I think that there's different levels of reading them. You know, the Supermarkets in Italy poem, every time I read it at a reading, it gets laughs. Like, I want people to laugh. But then I also want them to be able to go back and look at it again. Similarly with the poem Sexual Assault Awareness Week, again, people always, at readings, people always laugh at certain lines. And I want it to be something where it's making fun of a lot of different things, but also something that can be read on a different level besides just poking fun.
Well, I wonder if you might read a poem that doesn't seem all that funny.
Okay, yeah, sure.
Reconstruction?
Yeah, I'll read a depressing poem.
Reconstruction, which is where the title of the chapbook comes from.
Oh, yeah, that one. Reconstruction. Piece by piece, the walls fall. Sheltered behind paintings and pictures, a hidden world of mouse goop, cord arts. The colors of memory, flesh tones and grass. White numbers you wore on your back, sweat soaking through. We say we will put it back together after all the dirt is cleaned out. We dream of walls painted blue, mold dried out to dust. Punch a hole through the house and we will call it a window. Call it a window and we will sleep under the stars.
Well, that seems to be a metaphor.
Yeah, you know, I guess it is a metaphor. but you know, I'm not sure what it is a metaphor for.
Well, those are my favorite kind.
All right, good.
So I was wondering if you could talk a little more about your NYU experience. You know, we went to NYU at the same time or partly the same time, and yet...
Yeah, I graduated in 2010. Were you also 2010 or 2009?
2010, but I lingered. I got there 2007.
I see. Okay.
And so I saw you several times every week, and, you know, we were chatty, and I had no idea what you were doing over there, so...
Right. Well, I knew you were a fiction writer, and you knew I was a poet, and that's sort of all that... I mean, that's all I was really doing. Do you mean like my NYU experience with my classes or with my extracurriculars? Because in my experience, the extracurriculars took up more time than the classes and sometimes more time than the writing itself.
Well, let's start with the extracurriculars then.
So my first year at NYU, I was a Goldwater Fellow, and I taught creative writing at Goldwater Hospital with a group, and I also did an individual tutorial. And that program was amazing. It was started by Sharon Olds. And then my second year, I was a StarWorks Fellow, so I taught creative writing at a children's hospital with my friend Martin. We taught together in Queens. And also from my first year at NYU, I started doing this America Reads part-time tutoring position at a middle school in Bed-Stuy. And that comes through in some of my poems, too. A lot of political activists are really wealthy, really have a lot of money and time. And working there at the charter school, I was not around people who had a lot of money and time. You know, I think that virtually all of the students were on some sort of governmental assistance. Virtually all of them qualified for free school lunches. So I did that from my first year into the middle of my second year. I did Goldwater, I did StarWorks, and I taught at NYU my second year. I also worked on the literary magazine. So all of those extracurriculars took up more time for me than classes, and even really in my second year, more time than writing. My second year of grad school, I had very little time to write. And so as a result, I had to give myself the year after finishing grad school to only work part-time and spend a lot of time writing. So that was kind of strange, but I don't regret any of those experiences. I mean, I do wish that I had somehow had an extra 3 days in the week to write, but then at the same point, I wouldn't have given up any of those things that I did, especially teaching in a hospital. So two different hospitals and the teaching experiences were amazing.
Could you talk a little bit more about that experience?
So with Goldwater, the Goldwater program was started by Sharon Old decades ago, maybe even in like the, I don't know, I don't want to exaggerate, it might even be the 1970s. And Goldwater Hospital is a hospital that's located on an island between Manhattan and Queens. It used to be called Welfare Island. It was a quarantine island. And right now, there are places to live there, but it's mostly hospitals. It's a hospital island. So teaching there is kind of like teaching in a prison. There's panhandlers in the hospital. I saw someone arrested once there. There's a drug trade that, you know, patients get medication and sometimes they sell it to outside the hospital. The patients there are all adults and they're there for long term. They have some sort of long-term care that can only be given in a hospital. So patients aren't necessarily acutely ill, but they are, you know, they need round-the-clock care. Some patients are there because there are gunshot wound patients who have gang affiliations. I broke my hand after I finished grad school, and I had to go to the ER, and I was talking to the nurse practitioner who was putting the bone back in place, and I told him, oh, you know, I used to work at Goldwater Hospital, and he was like, you worked at Goldwater? Like, they must have eaten you alive. And it was like, yeah, I mean, it's strange to get catcalled in a hospital. you know, like, you kind of think to yourself, wait, did that just really happen? So the interior of Goldwater Hospital is a lot like the bad parts of New York City. Something else I learned when I was working there was some of the people you see, you know, selling watches on the street. There was a patient who I met there who did that. You know, he lived in the hospital, and during the day he took the subway into the city and sold watches on the street, and then at night came back to the hospital. But yeah, I think the prison analogy is probably a good one to use. I also worked with someone there who had been sexually assaulted at the hospital by another patient. The nurses were, you know, severely understaffed. I did not have good experiences with most of the nurses there, although the nurse who was the liaison for the group was incredible. And, you know, it required a different way of looking at writing. Also, you know, some of the patients there maybe didn't even have a high school education. Other of the patients had master's degrees or even doctorates. And so to teach a workshop, you had to bring in something that can appeal to a really, really wide range of people.
Which is a lot different than the writer's house.
Yeah,
E.L. Doctorow walking around and Sharon Olds and...
Yeah. But, you know, Sharon Olds was one who started the program, and I really admire how she sees poetry in the world. She said something once in New York Times that she thinks that poetry should be in laundromats and supermarkets and hospitals, and I completely agree with her. But, yeah, it was difficult. It was really stressful. It was really draining. And it made it difficult to write. You know, doing that experience for 2 years in grad school was great for my teaching, not so much great for my writing. So that was Goldwater, and that was working with adults. And then the next year, my second year of grad school, I was working at a children's hospital. At Goldwater, there was a group of 7 of us, and I really got close to the people in that group. I actually ended up living with one of them. He was my roommate for like 3 years. But then my second year, I was at a children's hospital, and it was just me and one other person. And that was also really difficult, but, you know, in a different way. The hospital was really, really good, and the kids were really, really well cared for. And so in that way, it was maybe a little bit easier because I felt like I was part of a team of people that were helping these kids. But yeah, again, same thing. It took a lot of time to get there. Both of these places were really, really hard to get to from where I was living. You know, so it took up a lot of time to get there. Lesson planning took a long time. And then, you know, it's emotionally draining. You're in a hospital for 2 hours. You kind of just want to, I don't know. One of the strangest things about grad school for me was how, so Sharon Olds is really a confessional poet, and so a lot of the poets there write confessional poetry, including me. But it's difficult to place yourself in these really emotionally draining situations to just go from a hospital to, say, going to a poetry workshop where one of your friends is writing about something really terrible that happened to them. And so it really shaped me.
It must have felt like a second dose of tragedy for the day if you've taught at the hospital and then you've got trauma being dealt with in the poetry workshop.
Yeah. So it was quite a lot on my plate. And, you know, some people deal with it better than others. I think that personally, I didn't really deal with it that well, especially after I was finished working in the hospital. So after grad school, you know, I would get really anxious and scared that one of my family members was going to end up in the hospital or that something bad was going to happen to them. It was really strange. And again, not something that I expected.
Well, I do remember Darren Strauss, who was one of my craft class teachers, told me something wonderful. He said that he didn't make much headway on Chang and Eng until after he graduated. That Chang and Eng was his project while he was writing at NYU, and Doctorow had praised the work and sort of encouraged him. But really, it wasn't until he was all done that he really, really got cooking with it. And yeah, because I don't know anyone who felt like they got enough writing done while they were in the program.
Yeah, definitely. Did you feel that way too with your own writing? I mean, were you able to do more after you'd finished?
Well, I'm not sure. Okay. So much of my life is spent hustling after work, actually. I feel like I have the economic stability of a Scottish poet of the 19th century. So I've really, you know, my time at NYU was either spent teaching or trying to find teaching gigs. And so I'm quite happy now that the University of Central Florida is giving me an excellent place to teach, actually. That's secure and solid, but it's, you know, even with that, I find that, you know, it's a 4-4 teaching load. Mm-hmm. So I have windows of time when I'm not teaching, and that's when my pipeline needs to basically go on overdrive. Things happen only in trickles sort of while I'm teaching. Like if I don't do anything, then I just, I'll just stew and be filled with anxiety. So I need to do a little bit. And actually, you know, I've been working on my poetry more recently because if I have 20 minutes here and an hour tomorrow, I can produce a decent poem sometimes if my muses are kind.
Yeah.
Whereas I need to come up with an idea for my next novel that requires research, and that's just not entirely hopeless, but not something I could make reliable progress on right now.
Yeah. You know, it's funny because the other week I was working on a short story, and I almost only write poems. It's pretty rare that I write stories. And I was just like, wow, I have to work on this every night for a week to finish it. But with a poem, I can just finish it in one night. It's really different. So I know what you mean about, like, okay, you know, you can set aside an hour and actually finish a thing, which is such a good feeling. Whereas with fiction, it can be almost impossible to do that.
So here's a question. When you're writing a poem, do you feel like you mostly have it on a first draft? Or do you labor over it for many, many drafts before you know if it's a good poem or not?
No, I pretty much know on the first draft if it's, you know, worthwhile. But, you know, maybe the term first draft isn't even the right way of putting it, because I pre-write before the draft often. I put down ideas, I write down images, almost like I'm outlining. So even before the first draft, I've already written down a bunch of different things that I'm thinking about. And then once I write the first draft, I don't usually wait to revise it. I write the first draft, and then I rewrite it again in a second draft, and then I do that, like, you know, 4 or 5 times. In my experience, I get the best revision. The best revision for me happens right after I've written the poem. Not like a week after, not like 2 weeks after, but, you know, right then.
Has that always been your process?
No, it hasn't been. I guess with grad school, I feel like, you know, there's a lot of debate over the workshop model and if the workshop model is useful or if it just produces, you know, stuff that's good by consensus or...
Revising to please a consensus usually means that no individual reader is actually happy with the result,
yeah.
I find.
Yeah. So, but I think the workshop was useful for me, and just in terms of having an audience and seeing what works and what doesn't work. And after, you know, being in consistent workshops for 2 years, plus the workshops I was in college, I have a better eye for my own work now, and I have a better idea of if I write something, if it's good or not. Before I went to grad school, I thought everything I wrote was, like, pretty good, just about the same amount of good. and now I can look back on it and know, okay, that's not the case, and also look at what I write now and say, okay, I can step away from this and figure if it's good or if it's not good.
Yeah, and I'm not sure I'm there yet.
With
my own poetry.
I might lose this skill. I'm not placing any bets on it.
How did Call It a Window come together?
Well, actually, just to go back to this answer, to go off again of a previous question about, like, how revising and how you know things. One of the things that I've had to struggle with, I guess, is this. You mentioned earlier Billy Collins and a thesis and one of your students saying, you know, wishing that Billy Collins had a thesis. I think that some of my poems almost have punchlines. So, you know, where something twists or where something turns. And I think one of the things that I have to revise sometimes or change is, okay, what is the turn in this? What is the punchline? And is that enough to hold up the rest of the poem? So, you know, I might think that, like, the whole poem revolves around one metaphor or one change or one shift in perspective, but that one thing might not be the right thing. So that's something that I work on, and often one of the things that I have to change when I revise my poems, I have to revise, you know, the turn or the shift in the poem.
So the endings.
Yeah, well, kind of. I guess the ending. But, you know, most of the time, if an ending isn't working, it's because of something that comes in the beginning.
So the setup for the turn could be the problem.
Yeah, exactly.
The turn is the problem.
The setup's not strong enough. The setup doesn't do the job, so the ending isn't holding up.
I find your use of the word turn interesting. Because it's a term used to describe what happens in sonnets at the very end, where the poem we thought we were reading turns out to have a different message.
Yeah, exactly.
And I find that a useful teaching analogy, even though mm-hmm. I don't want my students to write sonnets necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
I do find that teaching the way that works evokes the sort of emotional surprise that we do expect from poetry.
Yeah. I like that term, emotional surprise. Another way I think about that emotional surprise thinking about it as something that's both surprising and inevitable. Like, it couldn't have ended any other way, and yet the ending is still a surprise. It still feels new.
Well, and that would come to us from our pal Aristotle, who I've been dodging and arguing with for years, but I think ultimately I agree with him, even though I'm not happy about it. So how did Call It a Window come together?
So the year after grad school, I was just writing and sending out individual poems. So that was the year after I graduated, so like fall of 2010 to spring 2011. And then in the summer of 2011 was when I started sending out my chapbook and full-length manuscript. So I always had an idea of putting out a work that was organized by location. So when I was, so in like the fall of 2010, I put out a zine that was called Poetry Maps, and it had poems arranged by neighborhood and maps. So maps of where the different poems took place. So that was sort of how I came about organizing it. By the book is organized in three sections: Manhattan, Other Islands, and Brooklyn. And Other Islands was another title that I thought of for the manuscript. So I was sending out my chapbook manuscript, and I think it was maybe arranged in like four sections, like Manhattan, Long Island, Brooklyn, or like Manhattan, Queens, Brooklyn, Long Island. And then nobody was really picking it up, so I was like organizing it in alphabetical order. Like, I don't know why I thought it would be a good idea to organize it in alphabetical order, but I knew it should be in sections because every other chapbook I saw was also in sections. Like, not anything specifically having to do with the poems, but like everyone else whose chapbook manuscripts were getting published had it in sections. So with the Midwest Writing Center, I saw, you know, I think on Poets and Writers, I saw about their contest, and maybe this is going to sound terrible, but I hadn't heard of them. And I thought to myself, well, this isn't like the most important prestigious chapbook prize. This isn't like the Poetry Society of America or something. Like, of course, if they pick up my chapbook, I will be so happy and overjoyed, but this isn't the most important or the most competitive. This isn't the most competitive competition I'm entering, so let me try something different. So then I organized the poems, as you see in this manuscript, and called that one section Other Islands. And I think this was the only place that I sent out the manuscript in this form to, and they were the ones who chose it.
So it seemed like it worked.
Yeah, so it worked. Yay. Yeah, and you know, it's funny, when I got the email from them that it had been chosen, I thought it was a joke, like I thought it was BAM or something like that. I didn't believe it.
So what was it like dealing with the Midwest Writing Center Press?
It was good. You know, I don't really have much to compare it to. The only, you know, there were like a few snags along the way. So, for example, my book was listed on Barnes & Noble, but Barnes & Noble wasn't actually selling it, and people tried to order it on Barnes & Noble, and then I guess in theory maybe they've reordered it from Amazon, but I have no idea if they actually reordered it or not from Amazon. So that was a little annoying. But yeah, it was fine. And it was really good, actually. I think the best part about working with them was meeting them at AWP, because at AWP, it's, you know, the free conference, and I got to sit at the table and sign autographs. In retrospect, I think it would be a lot easier publishing with a press that is local to me. Because, for example, if I lived, the Midwest Writing Center Press is based out of the Quad Cities in Iowa. I think they're precisely in Davenport, Iowa. And so if I lived in Davenport, Iowa, I'm sure I could get a local bookstore to carry it, or I could tell my friends, oh, you know, just go to the Midwest Writing Center. They're located on such and such a street, and you can pick up a copy there. I wish that my book was in local bookstores in Brooklyn, but for better or for worse, there are, you know, the New Yorker put it well that one of Brooklyn's main exports is writers named Jonathan. So there's just so many bookstores and so many writers that, you know, it's difficult to get a local bookstore to carry my book.
Oh, so the heartbreak of not getting to see your book on the shelves.
Yeah, and it would be really nice to see my book on the shelves, but it's tough, you know. You know, I live in Greenpoint, right next to Williamsburg. Like, Thurston and Williamsburg, you'll hit, like, three poets. But then again, on the other hand, living in Brooklyn gives me a lot of opportunities to read my work and to meet other writers that I don't think I'd have in other parts of the country. I mean, there's a trade-off. You know, I do wish that my press was located closer, or maybe that I was located closer to them.
Do you feel that as a teacher, you look at poetry differently when you have to explain to others how to do it?
You know, that's an interesting question. I've been teaching for such a long time that the two are really close to each other. So I know I mentioned to you my junior year to senior year was when I started really thinking about poetry. But my first semester senior year was also when I TA'd for a poetry class. So twice a week, well, it was creative writing. So twice a week I was teaching creative writing, mostly poetry. So so I've just spent so much time teaching and writing that my learning of poetry is really wrapped up with being a teacher as well as a student.
So not so many surprises on that front.
Yeah, not many surprises. I tend to have a pretty good idea of what my students will like and what they'll hate in terms of how they'll react to something. I think maybe one of the biggest surprises I've had was at NYU teaching at Goldwater Hospital and seeing how well the students and how much the students really liked writing in form. You know, I hated writing in form. I hated trying to write a sonnet or a sestina. I didn't even like, I remember my first semester of graduate school, somebody brought in a sestina at a workshop, and I didn't even know that it was a sestina. So I think maybe my biggest surprise was how well my students react to poetry that's written in form. So sonnets, villanelles, they love villanelles. Sestinas, not so much.
You can't see it, but I'm actually shivering at the list of all these different forms.
With happiness?
No. No, I am surprised that people still are hungry for these forms.
Yeah, I mean, I think that they see those forms as a gateway into understanding the poem. And also, there's the pleasure of anticipation. So in a villanelle, you know certain lines are going to repeat. And so they definitely find pleasure in listening to it. I mean, I haven't recently, at least, I haven't taught creative writing, so this is more in literature classes. They really seem to like those forms, in some cases more than they like free verse. And, you know, it's just like an open door to entering into the poem. And it also, here's another thing, it gives them something that they can immediately recognize. So if you teach students, okay, this is a villanelle, this is what a villanelle looks like, and then the next week you put a poem in front of them and you say, okay, what kind of poem is this? The person who can raise their hand and say, this is a villanelle, which will be like 90% of the class, already they feel good. Already they feel, oh, I get this. One of the complaints you hear most often in teaching is, well, I just don't get it. And if you teach students to recognize a form, then at the very least they've quote-unquote gotten that. And they can identify it, they can say this is a villanelle, then they can relate it to other villanelles. Yeah, it's just like a good way for them to right away know that they understand something about the poem.
Well, and yeah, there's something reassuring about the form. And when poetry has to rhyme, that somehow reassures students that poetry having an elevated cultural status, well, if you can rhyme well, then you've earned that cultural status, even though I don't agree with that either. And, you know, when we point out famous examples of sestinas or villanelles, I don't like those either, I find.
Wait, what was that?
Well, when we present historical examples of great villanelles and sestinas, I find I don't like those either. Maybe it's just I'm cranky and old. I don't know. I do like sonnets.
Well, and one of the most fun things about teaching villanelles is finding the YouTube video of Dylan Thomas reading Do Not Go Gentle Into That Good Night. And, you know, once you show someone that video, his voice is, like, so booming and he's repeating these lines. I mean, there's no way to not be drawn into that.
Well, that is the one. Yeah, that's the one example. But on the other hand, at least for creative writing, good luck writing one of those that can compete with that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Dylan Thomas can't read your poem. Should you write something as good as Do Not Go Gentle Into the
Dark of Night? Yeah. If only he could.
Well, and really, he's going back to what you were saying earlier about how for you, hearing a poet read the work is almost, if not more important than actually just sitting down and reading a book of the poem.
Yeah.
His career seemed almost based on his ability to read his work dramatically.
Yeah.
Entrance the listener.
Well, here I'm going to align myself with my students a little bit. I mean, so I'm 26, and I've been teaching college since I was 24, and I started TAing for a college class and teaching it when the professor was absent when I was 20, turning 21. You know, I'm used to things like YouTube videos. I'm used to watching something for 2.5 to 3 minutes. I have a Tumblr page where I post a lot of poetry links. Like, there's something that seems really natural to me about listening to something for just a minute or 2 minutes or 3 minutes. And also, and just listening to it and then moving on to something else. I think that poetry is really, really adaptable to this sort of, I don't know, I don't want to say internet age, but, you know, Tumblr and YouTube are great for poetry. They're really, really good for it. And I can see poetry moving or maybe even seeing some sort of a rebirth in that direction.
Outside of the normal channels of publication?
Well, maybe not outside of the normal channels of publication. So, for example, one of the Tumblrs that I follow on Tumblr is Poetry Magazine. It's called Poetry Since 1912. And they publish on their Tumblr, you know, poems from back issues, so poems that have been in Poetry Magazine. They also publish stuff in their archives, like they publish pictures from the archives of Langston Hughes, rent party invitations. So it's not so much that I see poetry going around the channel of Poetry Magazine, but that I see Poetry Magazine existing not only as a magazine that, you know, gets delivered to your house, but also something that you follow on Tumblr that things from their archives that will publish photographs and you know, paraphernalia.
So I was wondering if you could read one last poem.
Yeah, sure. Actually, hold on a second because my cell phone is running out of batteries. Do you have a request for the poem or can I just choose anything?
Summer, unless you have a stronger preference.
Okay, cool. And that's funny. I was actually thinking about reading that one too. Just a second. I've got to plug my phone in. This poem is kind of strange because I wrote it and there was almost no revision in this poem. I also wrote it and then forgot about it, that I'd written it until I was looking to put together a chapbook, and then I found it again, you know, hidden in the Microsoft Word file. So summer. On Tuesday afternoon, the rain rising from the sidewalk carried with it little dog poop particles. It's amazing the jobs you never tell your parents you work. Artist, model, shot girl, babysitter of rich wives. I hate being asked what I desire. Sometimes it feels like there's a cord from my knees to my sternum that gets plucked when our knees touch, but sometimes not. I almost always date vegetarians, and my cheap cell phone distorts voices too much for long, meaningful conversations. I'm tired of talking in cars while the world blurs outside plastic windows. My problem is to fuck like I was in love when I really wasn't, and now I don't know how to fuck at all anymore. I want you to look at me. I'm a vegan who sneaks banana bread without asking the ingredients and who doesn't stop the waiter who adds baba ganoush to my falafel. I want to say I've already done my part, but that's never true. Do you know of the stroke victim who writes poems with her toe? She always starts with the first letter and turns her head from side to side like a runner's arms pumping through air. Now I've sobered up. Now I'm waiting for a phone call from someone who I hurt.
Well, thank you, Monica.
Great, thank you.
It's been lovely to talk to you. I don't think I've ever talked to you this long before.
Yeah, it's been great.
And now, for something that is not the last thing we just did.
Olivia Kate Cerrone reads her essay, Why I Still Watch the Watcher in the Woods.
Thank you. 8 years old when I watched The Watcher in the Woods for the first time in the back of my parents' video store. I'm a little nauseous from the strange plastic odor coming from the air conditioner, the mildew rising from the carpet. My butt is already sore from my undersized play school chair. Next to the cash register, a television squats in a corner between the horror and adult movie sections of the store. Although I am forbidden to even touch any of those movies, my proximity to them is, interestingly enough, never questioned by my parents. To my left are rows of gore, images of Freddy Krueger, The Exorcist, Jack Nicholson's crazy mug from The Shining. To my right are the porno titles in thick, oversized black binders and a shelf built into the wall. Before me is a young woman trapped in glass. There's something very erotic about being spooked. The trapped girl is a blonde in a white dress and white blindfold, pressing her hands to the soft focus of the mirror from the inside of the glass. Her fingers are spread wide, feeling for any sign that she can enter into this world. She cries out in a disturbingly inhuman voice, ethereal, distorted, as if played backwards underwater. In that ghostly, angelic light, her blindfold makes her so vulnerable, virginal. And yet her hands are not tied. Why doesn't she take the blindfold off? Is it in some way that she is choosing this altered state of bondage? And yet her fear is so urgent. When I see her, I feel a gruesome fear. I don't have time to look away, and a rush of adrenaline goes straight to my brain. And there is a satisfying treachery in understanding that Disney somehow wanted to lead me to this place of such intense, desperate fear. Usually, the Sorcerer's Apprentice logo began Disney movies that were benign and cute. There is another teenager on the outside of the mirror who receives a shock when she touches her own hands to the surface to see if she can touch the trapped girl. The glass cracks. If I press my fingertips to the television screen, might that glass crack also? I so identified with the trapped girl, though. Earlier in the movie, Miss Aylward, played by the perfect airiness of Bette Davis, asked the teenager in this world, "Are you a sensitive person? Do you sense things?" What I sense, sitting there, is that Bette Davis is asking me the question, "Am I? Am I sensitive enough to do what it takes? Can I reach her?" The need to repeat things is normal for children, but this movie, it felt like someone was trying to reach me, roving through the forest and reflected surfaces. The watcher in the woods was trying to reach me, which is why I watch it. Which is why I watch it.
And now, the Drunken Odyssey mailbag.
Right now we're listening once again to the music of the Intoxicators. While there is no surfing off my Mad Phallic Peninsula worthy of the word, the rocking out by the Intoxicators crests the listener up, soaring over the asphalt, sea grape, and palm trees into the starry blur of history, and now, and the moment that is tomorrow, miles above the Atlantic and out into the darkening rolls of ocean, of all that is unholy and wild and unthinkable in one's own corpuscles and marrow, synapses and soul. Their music is of the darkest grit, a pounding of the big ether, a mandatory provocation to flail, twist, and batusi. I doff my dome to the maker for making this bunch. They have saved my life times beyond reckoning. If you blink and but half think of Florida, you'll envision a hothouse of kitsch no other geography could sustain. These ghosts are damned hungry.
All right.
right, we've got three letters in this week's mailbag. Mono Lumen Garcia asks, what adult beverage goes with your top 10 recommended books? Well, this is a question of such magnitude, I think I will defer answering until next week. Jason Roeder, a humorist who has written for The Onion and happens to be the funniest man I know, asks about the role of outlining. He says, it's an old topic, but I'm always curious what people start with when they sit down to actually write. So I presume that he means books here, working on long projects. Now, this is something that Yaroslav Kalfar and I talked a little bit about in episode 2 when we discussed John Gardner's The Art of Fiction, and that also will come up in our next conversation, which will be featured on episode 6, in which Yaroslav and I discuss Stephen King's On Writing. Stephen King doesn't approve of outlining, and neither does E.L. Doctorow. E.L. Doctorow once wrote, writing is like driving at night in the fog. You can only see as far as your headlights, but you can make the whole trip that way. I'm not sure I can. I'm sure he can, but I'm not sure that I can. So the first answer I have to give, of course, is that whatever the hell works for you is the thing that you should be doing. The second answer, though, is a little bit more nuanced and is oriented towards writers who don't know if they have an approach to this that works. One thing that I see so many young novelists do is they're so intent on building, imaginatively building their fictional worlds, that they tend to write horizontally rather than vertically. That is to say, they're constructing perfect cities for their stories to take place in, but their stories are not moving forward. They have no momentum. And so that can lead to all kinds of crises and writers going into their books, trying to find out what their voice should be in the book, trying to find out what their story should be in the book, so that writing a novel can take years. And this prospect frightens me because I don't have years. And I'm not sure most writers do either. So I do think that outlining can be a healthy process. Now, ideally, what most writers want is a sense of plot that is character-driven. However, characters can rebel, characters can be not helpful material and actually prevent stories from moving forward. This is something that E.M. Forrester writes about hysterically well in aspects of a novel. So in E.L. Doctorow's formulation, I have found that sometimes the car winds up stuck on a roller coaster track embedded in Jell-O. So while I'm perfectly confident that he can find his way through the fog, I'm not sure everyone else can. Having said that, of course, the danger is that your novel plan becomes too rigid and doesn't seem to give the characters choice. And it is the way that characters, at least this is the way it is in capital R realist fiction, and this is the way that it is for popular fiction and most of literary fiction, what we want to see are the choices that characters make, because it is through making those choices that those characters are defined. That is, their characters grow. They change in response to the provocations of the world that they find themselves in. We want to see what happens once they are exposed, once they become more aware of who they are based on the challenges that life has given them. And so it can be counterintuitive to try and plan that. So I do think that outlining can be really helpful, but you also need to try and approach outlining flexibly. But if you're going to try and write a novel, it's so important to think of very, very basic things, like what's going to keep the reader reading? What are we reading to find out? When you're building a whole world, the reader may be falling asleep. We want to know, oh, is Mrs. Dalloway going to be able to get the flowers, for example? That gives us a reason to keep reading. As simple as that is the engine that keeps writing going. That is the engine that keeps a story going. And those are things that you can plan. So I think a lot of emphasis is sort of placed on the structure of the outline, rather than thinking of it as a list of scenes that will keep moving the story forward. So figuring out the list of scenes, I think that is absolutely key. And it's okay if in the writing of it, in the process of discovery, that your plan changes. But I'm not sure most people can be trusted not to have a plan at all. And so if you can wing it, I know that's what Stephen King does. I know that's what Dave Barry does. But he also, in the acknowledgments to Big Trouble, he notes that Ridley Pearson, his friend, knows what he'll be having for breakfast next year. So whatever works for you, that's what you should be doing. I myself find that I kind of do both. That I am inspired to write and I just see where it goes. But the whole prospect of the whole story is something that sooner or later I buckle down and try to figure out. My first, the novel that I completed, Guy Sacco and the Ziggurat of Shame, I actually went into an empty classroom and on a giant dry erase board just wrote down all the major movements and then looked at the holes and I could see where I could see how to fill in the rest of the story. Of course, it is an adventure story, and it's a zany adventure story, which is a little bit easier to contend with, but I did find that really helpful. And as silly as it sounds, part of the secret, because I've been wrestling with this for months, part of the secret to solving the problem was writing it out really, really big on the dry erase board. Something about the size of that I found really helpful. All right, my friend Susana Gonzalez asks, how does technology affect your writing process? Considering technology, including that wonderful typewriter of yours, to the latest version of the tablet now. I have to confess, I have a tablet-like device. I barely know how to use it. I would only use it in an emergency. But I do type, you know, most of my writing happens straight on the computer. The problem with writing on the computer is it invites so many distractions. Facebook is right there. The New York Times is right there. YouTube featuring all kinds of epic misfortunes that are somehow worse than my own are right there. And even when I am in a mental frame of mind where I am eager to work, occasionally I come across something I am writing where I need to do a smidgen of research. And so I go online looking for that research and then the research goes sideways. Oh, well, this leads to that, and isn't that fascinating? And because writers are such curious people who in fact most of the time would prefer not to be writing, it gets really, really tempting. On the plus side, however, you know, I have so many projects that are in the pipeline. I have so many notes for so many years that one of the great things I can now do on my computer is simply do word searches, and my Macintosh will now track down wherever those words appear, which means that I am able to find things that I've written when I can't remember what the name of the fucking document was. And that is an extraordinary gift that I did not have 10 years ago. I maybe needed it less 10 years ago, but still. And of course, on a really obvious basis, you know, revision is incredibly helped by working straight on the computer. As for that old typewriter, I seldom take that out of the box, but when I do find that I concentrate awfully well. The pace of writing is slower, and something about the physical sensation, that great resistance of the keys, makes me more keenly aware of my own physicality, which reminds me more of the physicality of my characters, which I do think helps the sense of realism in what I write. Even though what I write tends to be kind of crazy, emphasizing the physicality of what I'm writing about tends to be really persuasive, and working on the typewriter really deeply helps that. And it lacks the distractions of working on the computer. Did you know that a Royal typewriter has no access to Facebook at all? It's true. And that's all for today's mailbag. Remember, dear listeners, if you want me to respond to your mail, please send it to thedrunkenodyssey@gmail.com. Well, that's all I got for today. Folks, I'm still carrying around this cold that I had at Bloomsday. I'm not drinking enough. Okay, keep your ass in the chair, keep pumping out words, and don't swallow the worm.
Thank you for listening to The Drunken Odyssey with John King, a podcast about the writing life. This is your announcer, Lauren Butler.